Good evening and welcome to City Visions. I'm your host, Joseph Pache. San Francisco is grappling with a widening wealth gap. The latest tech boom has increased economic divisions and tensions are running high over Google buses, a strained housing market, and a changing city. Last month, the Brookings Institute released a study that showed that from 2007 to 2012, San Francisco's wealth gap widened at a faster rate than that of any other city in the U.S. San Francisco now has the second largest wealth gap in the nation, behind only Atlanta. While Atlanta's gap is because of extreme poverty at the bottom, San Francisco's gap is attributed to extreme wealth at the top. How can San Francisco become more affordable? Are there cities that are finding a better middle ground between explosive growth or no growth at all? And is more affordable housing the answer? And what long-term implications does San Francisco face as income gaps continue to widen? Joining me in the studio to discuss these issues tonight are Enrico Moretti. He's a professor of economics at the University of California, Berkeley, where he holds the PV Career Development Chair in Labor Economics. His research interests include labor economics, urban economics, and regional economics. His new book, The New Geography of Jobs, is available in bookstores. Welcome, Enrico.
It's good to be here.
We're also joined in the studio by Gabriel Metcalf. He's executive director of SPUR, a San Francisco-based nonprofit membership organization that promotes good planning and good government through research, education, and advocacy. Gabriel has authored or co-authored articles such as The Northern California Megaregion and Civic Planning in America. Welcome, Gabriel.
Great to be here.
And by phone, we're joined by Bob Brownstein. He is policy director at Working Partnerships USA, a research organization focused on state and local government issues. In this role, he manages a team that analyzes the dynamics of local economies, evaluates the needs of working families, reviews city and county programs, and proposes innovative policy initiatives. Welcome, Bob.
Good evening.
And, of course, we welcome you, our listeners, to join our conversation this evening. You can email us now at cityvisions@kalw.org. You can post a comment at the KALW website, and in about 20 minutes or so, we'll open our phone lines, and I'll give you the number now. It's 415-841-4134. Again, that's 415-841-4134. So, Gabriel Metcalf of SPUR, I wanted to start with you. President Obama said in his State of the Union address this year that income inequality is the defining challenge of our time. And he's talking about this affecting the entire nation. When we talk about San Francisco and the Bay Area, tell us about the unique aspects of this issue in our region.
Well, I think the president is right. And the Occupy Wall Street movement honestly has changed the conversation in this country in a way that is extraordinary and has got everybody, literally everybody, talking and thinking about economic inequality. It is, I think, important for us to start with an acknowledgement that it is a national story, if not an international one, and because the causes of economic inequality are big. They're big structural forces having to do with globalization, deindustrialization, the decline of the decline of organized labor, and you know other national things like changes in the tax structure that may be affecting you know returns to capital relative to returns to labor maybe, but when we shift to the local or regional level, we're trying to think about what is it that we can do constructively. And I think we have to start out with an acknowledgement that this problem is really difficult and no one really knows or we would have made more progress by now. But the difficulty is in trying to have local solutions to national problems like this. I hope Bob is able to talk a little bit about new strategies for the labor movement. That's absolutely a critical piece of what we need to be doing here in the Bay Area. I think we have a lot of progress that can be made on better workforce development systems, which is connecting people to the jobs that exist. You know, it should be easier here because we have a growing economy. That gives us other opportunities that you wouldn't have in a place like Detroit, but it's still really hard. At Spur, we've really put a lot of our focus for this year in the idea of a higher city minimum wage, which we think is one of the most kind of well-targeted measures that would help. But I'm hoping to learn more tonight about other things that might work too.
And you mentioned that there's a national and international factors that are creating the situation we find here. But can you dig a little deeper locally here and say what are some specific things that kind of are that kind of create our specific experience when it comes to economic inequality here in the Bay Area?
Yeah, well, the big factor locally is that we have a completely and totally dysfunctional housing policy, and that is not the fault of the national government. It's not the fault of deindustrialization. It is our own fault. And in essence, if you take a neighborhood like the Mission, which was built around transit, it has a really old building stock, really walkable, really wonderful. There was no new housing built for half a century. But as the Bay Area economy grew, as population grew, as cultural preferences changed and people wanted to live in a walkable urban neighborhood, you had increasing demand, but no increase in the housing supply. So in that situation, what happens is the people with more money win. They outbid the other people for the housing supply, and you have hyper-gentrification. So in other words, our housing policy just inflicts extra pain and suffering on everyone but the wealthy. And it's really what's so sad about that is we have that within our own power to fix entirely.
Anything else besides housing that you would think contributes to the issue here?
You know, no, I think the growing economy should be our opportunity. I think it still is our opportunity. We have to find better ways of connecting people to it, and we have to get out of our own way on housing policy.
I would turn to Enrico Moretti next to ask you if you can, I'm not sure how familiar you are with specific pieces of the job growth here in the Bay Area. But specifically, when we talk about job growth, what sectors are growing? And I imagine you'd say tech. But I'm curious, how broad-based is the job growth here? And is that part of the problem, that perhaps it's one sector or a couple of sectors that are growing, which doesn't make jobs accessible to a larger pool of people? And in fact, in many cases, we're attracting people from outside the area to come work here, as opposed to finding pathways for people who already live here to take advantage of the job growth. Is that a good way to frame some of this?
Well, surprisingly, job growth is fairly broad-based right now in the Bay Area. The Bay Area is blessed with one of the strongest labor market in the nation right now. The county of San Francisco added 20,000 new jobs in the last 12 months. Overall, the Bay Area ranks on the top of the labor markets that are the strongest right now. And this is, you know, one thing that people tend to forget, that only 3 years ago we were really worried about high unemployment, people losing their jobs, people being laid off. Right now we're worried about too many jobs. I would say that's progress. That's at least a better problem to have to manage. How broad based is it? Job growth right now in the Bay Area is driven by tech, but tech employs only a small fraction of the Bay Area workforce. Less than 20% of Bay Area workers working in the tech sector. 80% of Bay Area residents work in different sectors. What's happening is that the growth of tech is lifting other parts of the labor market. The inflow of money and new people is creating a pretty diverse set of jobs for workers in part of the labor market that are very far away from tech per se. you know, I'm thinking about people who work in jobs from, you know, real estate to architects to childcare specialists to therapists to lawyers and doctors. The inflow of wealth and new people essentially works as a generator of new jobs outside tech. My own estimates based on my research suggest that this multiplier effect is fairly large. For one tech job, you ultimately create five additional jobs outside the tech sector. So it's a big effect, and it's benefiting a diverse group of workers that are not necessarily in tech. You know, the job growth in nonprofit has been the most brisk it has been since the previous dot-com boom. So people who are working in trying to cure our social ills are actually benefiting from this additional wealth.
Although we had a show on a few months ago about how a lot of the nonprofits in San Francisco are struggling to stay housed here because commercial rents have skyrocketed. So that kind of brings us back to real estate. But I wanted to stay with this idea. So if indeed the job growth is broad-based and the tech industry, which has often been vilified in conversations like this, has a beneficial effect in spreading opportunity, so to speak, why then this economic inequality? Is it just that the jobs that are being created are just not at a living wage or at a living wage for San Francisco? What's the issue here?
Well, in part is what Gabriel was referring to earlier, is the increasing cost of living that is displacing some of the existing workers. Another piece of the puzzle is, if you look at the cities at the top of that Brookings study ranking of cities with high inequality and low inequality, the cities at the top, you know, San Francisco has high inequality, but it's not all that different from cities like Boston, New York, or D.C., or other dynamic, racially diverse centers that tend to attract two type of workers. The one who are highly skilled, highly, you know, well-educated professionals on one hand, and the type of workers that often are of immigrant origin who are much less skilled. These cities have, across the nation, they have a labor force that is often polarized, that has the sort of highly productive professional, in our case, tech workers, in the case of Boston, you know, life science researchers, in the case of New York, people who work in finance, but also the people who are much less skilled. You know, if you look at the municipality that has the least amount of inequality in the U.S., it's Beverly Hills. Why? Because it has only the rich. Mm-hmm. The second one is Flint. Why? Because it has only the poor. The Boston, D.C., New York, and San Francisco of the world have a fairly diverse group of workers, and that means also that essentially the gap between these two groups is large than in other more homogeneous, more suburban communities.
Mm-hmm. And is that a problem?
Well, it is a problem to the extent that we're doing nothing about cost of housing and rents. And I think I strongly agree with Gabriel that ultimately job growth per se is not a good thing. It's not a bad thing. It's actually a good problem to have. Economic growth is a good thing. We are much better off than many other communities in the U.S. But cost of living is going up. And so the real question to me is what to do about that. And I think that's where our policy leaders have failed us. San Francisco has constrained new housing for decades, and now it's paying the price for it.
And Bob Bronstein, I wanted to bring you in next. From the working families perspective, I'd like to hear your take on the conversation so far. It looks like, you know, we are creating more jobs here due to the current tech boom, but the income gaps are there as described, and that the costs of living are not being broached. The concerns raised just now, is that it for you? Is that the way you define this problem? Are there other elements that we're not talking about?
Well, the way I look at it is there's at least three major dynamics that are going on at the same time. One is deeply structural, and that is a national trend towards greater inequality and towards lower wages for the people whose incomes are below median, certainly below median, or, you know, even really below 60-70%. That's been going on for decades. Then there's cyclical dynamics, which is, you know, the business cycle booms and busts. We're now coming out of a bust, and when that happens, we experience very rapid increases in rent. Happened in the last recovery as well. So that compounds our local problem. And then there's geographic factors, which people have mentioned. Limitations on supply of housing in this region, which has a number of causes, some of them bad planning, some of them reasons of trying to maintain environmental quality, and some of them have a fiscal cause. Since Prop 13, housing doesn't really pay for itself in terms of cities being able to balance their books, so cities become housing at first. So you've got all three things, and San Francisco sort of has the trifecta. Right now it has all three hitting at once. The job dynamic that was discussed earlier, I think we have to recognize that the modern high-tech economy is one that, unless it is impacted by external forces, is going to generate some very good jobs at the top, but a very, very large number of low-paying, dead-end service jobs at the bottom. And the absence of middle-income wages is as much of this problem as is the inflation in housing costs. If you look at Santa Clara County, the heart of Silicon Valley, and look at the changes in real household income distribution between 2000 and 2010, the data is striking. For households earning less than $10,000 during this 10-year period, there was an increase of 127.7% of those households. Households 10,000 to 34,009, increase of 39.6%. But if you look at the high-income households, it was $100,000 or more, it was relatively flat. So what you've seen in the heart of Silicon Valley, San Jose likes to call it the capital of Silicon Valley, is what you see is very, very significant increases in the bottom of the hourglass, the low-wage jobs that are part of the tech economy, and relative stasis for the high-wage jobs. Of course, in that 10-year period, you had a boom and a bust. You had a cycle in there. But overall, there wasn't an increase. And at the top, and overall, there was a massive increase in the bottom. But bottom line is you need public policies that both deal with price inflation in housing and also ones that deal with the lack of middle-income jobs for a broad sector of the workforce.
Right, especially because a lot of those new tech workers really are living in San Francisco. They're really not necessarily choosing to live in Silicon Valley. But what we're hearing so far is that wages have even there that there are new jobs out, created, wages are just not keeping up with cost of living that seems to not budge. And I imagine there's a bigger dip in wages with each bust cycle, but not necessarily as big of a drop in cost of living, I imagine. Is that right, Enrico?
That's true, with the exception of the last cycle, which was particularly painful for homeowners and property owners because prices went down more than the typical cycle. There's another piece to this picture that I think it's worth mentioning, and it has to do with social mobility. You know, one thing is income inequality, which is at any moment in time how large is the gap between those at the top and those at the bottom. But another very interesting measure of how fair a society is or a region is how likely is that someone who is born at the bottom makes it to the middle or to the top. And 3 months ago, a new landmark study by some of my colleagues at Berkeley in conjunction with other economists at Harvard, came out measuring for the first time in a very systematic way social mobility for different metropolitan areas in the U.S. And one thing that comes out is that San Francisco does have a high degree of inequality, but is also at the very top in terms of social mobility. The U.S. as a whole is not a very mobile country. So the probability that someone born at the bottom makes it to the top is low compared to European countries, say. However, within the U.S., there are enormous differences. Places like San Francisco, Boston, and San Jose have a degree of mobility which is much higher than any other country in Europe. On the other hand, places like Detroit, St. Louis, Cleveland, and Atlanta have very low degree of mobility, meaning that those who are born poor in those cities stay poor. The bottom line here is that our economy, our local economy, I think its dynamism offered a chance for people who are born in a disadvantaged background to make it to the middle class, the upper class. At least it offers more of a chance relative to other cities. It's certainly still the case that even in San Francisco, if you're born at the bottom, you're more likely to stay at the bottom than if you're born at the top. But compared to other cities, we offer much higher degree of social mobility. And I think that's something that we should recognize, because cities like Atlanta that have the same degree of inequality that we have are essentially have no social mobility at all, and that's much more worrisome situation then.
So that's something to praise and say that we do have some opportunity there that we shouldn't overlook. In case you're just joining us, this is City Visions on Local Public Radio, 91.7 KALW San Francisco, and on the web at KALW.org. I'm Joseph Pache, and tonight we're discussing San Francisco's increasing wealth gap with Enrico Moretti. He's professor of economics at the University of California, Berkeley, Gabriel Metcalf, executive director of SPUR, and Bob Brownstein, policy director at Working Partnerships USA. If you'd like to join our conversation this evening, please dial in at 415-841-4134. Again, that's 415-841-4134. You can email us now at cityvisions@klw.org, or you can post a comment directly at the KLW website. So, Gabriel, I wanted to get back to you here about this issue of, you know, what we have, what we're up against in terms of our housing policy being a big part of this, but also that that even though with job opportunities, there's still quite a bit of wage stagnation, right? And then Enrico's point that, you know, but we do have the ability to give people opportunity maybe more so than other parts of this country. When you look at those three pieces, how do you start to understand how the conversation moves forward from here?
Well, I think what's so difficult about this problem of economic inequality is that that there are all of these really big causes, and the solutions are going to be from a lot of different sectors. And I mean, if you just take education, we have a major issue with our school system. That should be the greatest generator of opportunity for people. But in many cases, people are not coming out of school with the skills they need. But to complicate it further, even if a city like San Francisco does not do everything it should in terms of its education system, it doesn't necessarily pay the price itself, because there's so much mobility within the American population that people move all over the place. And so there's this almost free rider problem that you can do a bad job educating your youth and still, but they're not all necessarily going to end up living in your city. And so there's this kind of, once people are grown-ups, they move all over the place. And so it gets very complicated. You really need an educational system in the country as a whole that is equipping people with the skills to be productively in the workforce. There are examples that I think are working really well of industries that have ladders of opportunity into them. And I think the building trades is one that I know very well, where as a sort of craft union model, they have this system of apprenticeships that takes kids with no skills and trains them and pays them while they're being trained, and they get increasingly higher skills. And the people who hire that labor force are thrilled to hire union labor because they know that they'll be qualified. And so it's not only is it not a stigma, quite the opposite. People who are building things look for union labor. And so it's a model that exists in one sector that I think there's potential to apply in a lot of other sectors, you know, logistics and healthcare. And frankly, tech might be the hardest sector to build that because the skills change so frequently. But it's worth taking a run at it, even in tech. I think we have some models. We need to scale them up.
And I imagine that takes time, right? Now, an educational system is going to take us a decade or two, right, to see effects. The question is, what are some more immediate term solutions? But before we get to that, I wanted to pose a follow-up question to Bob Brownstein based on Gabriel's earlier comments about the labor movement and how organized labor can be part of this solution here. What's your thoughts on that, Bob?
Well, of course, the fundamental labor law in the United States is a national law, and the federal government has preempted the field. It's a law that, as implemented today, is not conducive to the growth of labor unions, as has been demonstrated by their decline over the past several decades. I think if you look at industrial democracies throughout the world, it's hard to find any where there is a significant degree of economic mobility that's not connected to a strong trade union movement. So the resurrection of collective bargaining should certainly be high on the list of any set of strategies to move forward. That said, there's a limited number of tools, although they're important, that can be done at the local level because of the national preemption. You can have local governments do project labor agreements when they have public projects to ensure that they're built with union labor. Many jurisdictions have labor peace provisions in their living wage laws, which require firms that get a contract from a local government to demonstrate that they're going to be able to guarantee labor peace, that is, a lack of labor disruption. And one way they can do that is by having a union contract. But in addition, a lot of the support for increased unionization is going to have to come from politics, not policy, politics. That is, community pressure from elected officials, efforts to give a black eye to firms that are claiming that they are responsible corporate citizens but are struggling to prevent low-wage workers from having the advantage of a union contract. It's very hard to see how we make progress in these kinds of areas without being willing to really get out into the meeting halls and the picket lines and the government decision-making arenas and being aggressive advocates for the kinds of public policies that can make a difference even if they don't solve the problem. Beyond union organizing, there's a host of other issues. Gabriel mentioned minimum wage policies and living wage policies and hybrids of the two. There's increasing interest in paid sick leave programs. These are raise the floor strategies that at least increase the standard of living of people who are at the bottom. There's kinds of ways you can use government leverage to try and induce the creation of quality jobs, public benefit zoning, community benefit agreements. And there's ways that politics can induce the development of industries that are likely to have a significant number of middle-income jobs. That's certainly been part of the rationale behind advocacy for a clean energy industry, a green energy industry. Obviously, there's other environmental benefits as well as job benefits. There's a good possibility that the Affordable Care Act will lead to significant opportunities for job growth in the healthcare field, particularly for people who have people skills that can help other people change their behavior in a way to be healthier. So it may not require math and science. It may require the ability to get other people to change their diet and exercise more. There are possibilities of encouraging the growth of these kinds of industries, and all of these kinds of strategies together have to form a gestalt of public policies and politics to try and resist these macroeconomic forces that are pushing in the wrong direction.
So I want to go to one of our callers here, put out the number again, 415-841-4134. Let's go to Michael in San Francisco.
Yes, hello.
Yes.
I do not really have a question, but I have some comments, and you can talk about them later. San Francisco, I think, as I observed, has seen its growth in the tech sector and technology workers. It's occurred over the last 20 years or so. And, before that, San Francisco had a little bit of light manufacturing and a lot of finance. But these tech workers, of course, have created a situation where they're high-paid individuals, as you've discussed. What they bring along with them, though, are the low-paid individuals who do kind of the service work to support that worker. The people that wash your clothes, that walk your dog, that take care of your children, that serve you a coffee. These are the low-paid workers who are only too happy to have these jobs. But those jobs, those lower-paid jobs, are created by the higher-paid jobs. Mm-hmm. Of those workers. And I'll make one last comment, and that is that we have shipped overseas all of our middle-income, middle-class industrial jobs. We've done that over the last 50 years. We've done it for political reasons, basically world peace, to put it succinctly. And those jobs, I don't see them ever coming back. I would love to see them coming back, build up the middle-class wage, and build up the middle class again, and, by the way, build up the trade unions that represented those workers. But I see them as gone, and unless we see a change in policy at the federal level, I don't think those jobs will ever come back. Thanks.
Thank you so much, Michael, for your call. We have an email here from Scott that says, how can you have mobility, and this is perhaps to you, Enrico, if you can't pay rent or have to pay 50% of your income on rent? It just doesn't make sense. So how do you square the numbers or the statistics you see about the potential for social mobility here in San Francisco with the current circumstances where people are having to pay so much just to stay housed? How do people then – how do they actually take advantage of this possible mobility?
Well, the reason why – so the city that has the highest mobility in the U.S., again, are San Francisco, New York, San Jose, and Boston. These are all very expensive cities, but they have one thing in common. They have a very dynamic local economy, and that's what gives the chance to at least some of those who are born at the bottom to make it to the middle or the top. It doesn't mean that that anybody can become a billionaire even in these places, but it does mean that these cities do offer more opportunities to the most disadvantaged of those who were born in this area.
But if the on-the-ground reality is something like what Scott is describing in his email, how does that turn into mobility? If you're struggling just to pay your rent and you don't have a lot of money to put aside for for a house, or you know if you're in a service job that was just described, you don't necessarily have a lot of mobility within that particular sector. I guess what I'm asking is, how can we reconcile what we think the experience is on the ground with what the statistics or the research is showing?
Well, there's no question that if your job is being a waiter, mm-hmm. you are going to make less money than if your job is a computer scientist. That's true everywhere in the United States. What's different in the cities that I was mentioning is that, for once, waiters tend to be paid a little bit better than in cities like at the other end of the spectrum, like the Detroit, the Atlanta, the Cleveland. And two is that some fraction of those who do have one of those low-paying jobs has a higher chance of making it to higher level of earnings than in these other less dynamic local economies. Going back to your question of what to do, it seems to me that one of the most important things that local governments in the Bay Area can do is to invest in the human capital, in the skills of their residents. And I think a very underappreciated factor in that landscape is the role that community college can play in transitioning people from low-paying, unskilled jobs into better-paying, more professional jobs. Community colleges there's a growing amount of research that shows that they play a very important role in giving opportunity to people and compressing, to some extent, wage inequality in places that invest in that type of education. And they have an effect on the labor market that is not, it doesn't take 20 years, but it's fairly immediate. An associate degree takes a couple of years. A lot of these colleges can even provide a BA. And they do, they're not as selective as, say, Berkeley or Stanford, but they do play a very important role in giving people opportunities and preparing them for those jobs. So in my view, a place like San Francisco or San Jose or any cities in the East Bay would be well served in really focusing on expanding professional opportunities and degrees that allow our residents to take advantage of the job creation that is going on right now.
So far what we've really talked about, and all three of you have made these comments, is ways in which raising wages, getting people to hop from one tier to the next by getting more training and or retraining are ways to help to sort of bring the bottom up, so to speak, right? So I'd like to shift our conversation in a moment to how are we going to bring the top down, so to speak, in terms of the things that we're struggling with, which is housing affordability primarily and cost of living that you've described. And I think perhaps our next caller may help us shift in that direction. Haiti from San Francisco. Haiti, welcome to the program.
Thank you. Thanks very much for the program. It's really, really crucial and very interesting to me. I wanted to make a comment about the role of commercial real estate, and that there are absolutely no controls or regulations on the rents of small businesses. I happen to live in Noe Valley. We have a situation in our neighborhood of a landlord who has a couple of small businesses in a building that he has owned for years, I imagine. At any rate, he's about to convert that building into the two small businesses who pay rent into one large space for which he will charge $10,000 a month. And above it, he will build condos that evidently will be sold for $2,500,000. So there you have kind of a metaphor of extreme, in my view, greed. And there are no controls. Why couldn't there be a policy where one of these small businesses has been in the community for years? And it seems to me some policy of protection for someone who has contributed to the community, who earns her living running a successful small business, should be compensated quite greatly for losing her livelihood.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that could be built into policy. Commercial rents are totally unregulated. That doesn't address housing, which is, again, another extremely crucial issue. I mean, the people who do the work can no longer live in this city. They have to commute 2 hours away.
Right.
And I'm not just talking about low-paid workers, a nurse, a teacher, whatever, cannot afford an apartment.
Right. And we've talked before on this program of how, you know, the unrestrained commercial rents can really change a neighborhood such that it does, you know, drive people out of the neighborhood, because then, you know, there's opportunities for, you know, condo conversions and other things that then price people out of the neighborhood. So it is the commercial housing market and the residential housing market are pretty inextricably linked. Thanks so much, Haiti, for your
Thank
call.
You. Thanks very much. Bye-bye.
And Bob, did you want to add to that?
Yeah, I wanted to raise the sort of a conceptual approach to this question that I think you're moving towards in terms of the relationship between higher income sectors and lower income sectors. The rationale for trade policies that have led to the loss of middle income jobs, and the rationale for supporting a tech industry, even though it generates gentrification and produces a lot of low paying jobs, is that the aggregate amount of positive externalities, the aggregate amount of good and wealth generated by these kinds of activities outweighs the losses, the costs to the people who are injured. And the political problem, assuming that's true, I'm not certainly sure that it is true, but assuming it is true, the political problem is you ought to then be able to take some of that excess wealth that's generated, which is the rationale for allowing these market mechanisms to go on in the first place, and use them to significantly mitigate the damage to the people who have paid the price to have this kind of economic policy go forward. But that is the precise kind of policy that we don't see happening.
And you're like talking about...
I'm talking about the fact that we have massive tax expenditures to help people with mortgage interest, but no tax expenditures to help low-wage workers pay rent. That we have, you know, 401k pension policies that benefit a relatively small percentage of the population that is in a relatively high federal tax bracket and has discretionary income to save, and is virtually useless to people who are at a low tax bracket and don't have any discretionary income to save. We don't have programs that tax the phenomenal financial holdings of successful international corporations and use that money to try and create public sector industries that could do good things, like either build infrastructure or provide assistance to our growing population and provide quality jobs at the same time. So it's not so much a question of bringing anybody down. It's trying to find a way that the economic largesse that's generated by this kind of dynamic economy isn't concentrated in just a few small hands, but is spread particularly to the people who are feeling the negative consequences that this kind of economy seems to essentially create.
415-841-4134 is the number to dial to join our conversation tonight, or you can email us at cityvisions@klw.org or post a comment at the KLW website. Here on City Visions, as we discuss the increasing wealth gap here in San Francisco, that was Bob Brownstein, Policy Director of Working Partnerships USA. Gabriel Metcalf is also here, Executive Director of SPUR, and we're also joined by Enrico Moretti, Professor of Economics at the University of California, Berkeley. So, Enrico, basically what Bob was talking about there, if I could paraphrase Bob, is sort of income redistribution in the sense of taxing at higher rates, those who have higher income, so that you can then use that money to help support those at lower income brackets. From the economist's standpoint, do you have examples to show that that works? What's the viability of something like that? You may not be able to speak to the politics of that, but is that a solution? And if it is, maybe the question is, why hasn't it been done more?
Right. Well, I disagree a little bit with Bob in the sense that I think some of it is already being done. We live in a state, California, that has the second highest income taxes in the nation. We live in a state where more than half of the state expenditure are financed by personal income taxes on the top 3% of taxpayers. So we are, in some sense, using some of the extra wealth generated by our lucky economic circumstances of attracting a lot of wealth to finance state services. I mean, the main reason why we have not a state deficit, but we have a state surplus, is exactly the fact that there's been a pickup in the income of the wealthy who pays the lion's share of our taxes. And those taxes go into the state coffers, and then they're used to finance our education, our roads, and our local services. Should we do more? Probably yes. Should we do across the board? Not really. I think we should focus on a number of important sectors, and I think education way more than, say, investment in infrastructure or public sector jobs. And he was mentioning, I think education should be our key focus. Gabriel is right that educated workers and college graduates tend to be a mobile bunch, so there's no guarantee that they're going to stick around unless the jobs are here. But it's also true that this is an appealing state for highly educated workers. And so I think it would be the marginal dollar invested in public education at the lower level, at the middle level, and at the higher level, where include colleges and community colleges, has one of the highest social return I can think of, way more than roads, way more than public sector jobs.
Gabriel.
Well, I just want to pick up on your question. It's a good one. Do we need to bring down incomes at the top? And I guess I want to acknowledge the feelings behind that, the kind of envy that I think is very human and understandable at people who have more money and more wealth and more options. And I think there are a lot of symbols of that kind of make people feel that wealth when you see somebody driving their Tesla or getting on their bus or any of those things. But if we use our heads on this, and I think, frankly, the focus really should be on lifting up the bottom. I don't think it benefits people at the bottom necessarily, it doesn't matter what's going on.
I appreciate your comment there, and what I was aiming by saying bringing down the top was sort of bringing down the top was the cost of living piece, because that's the part we talked about. I wasn't actually advocating for bringing down the top wages, but I'm sure there are some people out there who would advocate for that.
Yeah, of course,
for the reasons you might describe and for other reasons. Yes.
Okay, but in terms of bringing down the cost of living, I mean, what's so amazing about that is it would be free. It doesn't cost anything. We simply have to change our local land use regulations to make it much, much easier, faster, and cheaper to build housing. It's not the fault of the federal government. It's just our own doing. And what's in the way is, I think, a culture of maybe a culture of selfishness that we've come to tolerate because it's so ubiquitous that we've stopped noticing it. This idea that if something doesn't benefit us, we shouldn't let it happen. That if there's going to be a building built that blocks our view, that we have a right to stop it. Because we're set. We have a place to live. So why do we care if somebody else gets a place to live? There's a culture of
in theory, but not when it may affect me.
There's a culture of selfishness that I think is really at odds with progressivism, which is all about being open to people from all over the world to come make a go of it here.
So we have several callers that I want to try to get in before the end of the hour here. Let's go to Mark in San Francisco. Mark. Do we have Mark on the phone?
Yes. Can you hear me?
Yes, Mark. Go ahead.
Hi. So great panel tonight. I'm a San Francisco native, struggling to stay in town. Everyone in my family has left. Stanford graduate, good salary, still can't buy. And so I have a couple of thoughts around real estate policy, and I want to get your opinion. So one of the things that I know the Board of Supervisors are looking at is some reform around Ellis Act. And it seems that the premises are looking at providing people who may be displaced with a larger payout, if you will, to help them transition. I think that personally is problematic because you're providing people with more money, but if you run the numbers, it may mean that, I mean, effectively, they're not going to be able to find comparable housing at market rate, and so they might be able to buy a place, or excuse me, rent a place for 24 months instead of 12 months. It still means ultimately they're going to probably have to leave the city. So I'm wondering whether the focus should be more on something that really limits the exercise of Ellis Act, period, and somehow in some quasi-free market way helps people retain their long-standing status and rent control as opposed to just providing them with more funds to relocate. The second thought is something I believe they're doing in Sydney, Australia. And this speaks more to my nativism, but I hate the idea that so many native San Franciscans are being displaced. In Sydney, I'm paraphrasing, they've done something where only native-borns or people who have been residents for, I believe, 25 years or longer can buy resales. So this is buoyed by a lot of sociology research that says there are benefits of having at least a minimally sufficient percentage of native-born staying generation after generation. So they put that policy in place. Only new build is available to speculators or new arrivers. So I'd like to hear your opinions on both, please. Thank you.
Okay, thanks so much. Quickly, because I want to get to a couple more calls there.
Okay, quickly,
Gabriel.
On the issue of the Ellis Act and rent control, I mean, we've been supporting the general idea that units under rent control should stay under rent control. But you have to recognize that is a very short-term strategy that buys us a little bit of time. Whenever a unit turns over, it goes up to market rate. The question is, what do we do with that time it buys us? And we have to radically expand the housing supply or we're not going to be anywhere.
Okay. Did you want to add something there, Enrico?
Yeah, I think all we have to do is to look at the example of other progressive cities like Seattle. Seattle has experienced the type of tech-driven job growth that San Francisco has experienced over the past 5 years. In fact, job growth in Seattle has been even brisker, even stronger than in San Francisco. But Seattle has embraced the type of reform that Spur and Gabriel are talking about, where you depoliticize the entitlement process. They have land use regulation that are more pro-housing, and they end up with a growth in rent that is a fraction of what we have. So I think, you know, you don't need to go very far.
And how did they deal with the not in my backyard response?
I think there are people on this panel more qualified, but my understanding is that you, instead of having endless possibility of appeals and instead of having a lot of voice for the NIMBYs, there is a very rational, very professional planning process where the planners are not in the politics of deciding which neighborhood, they're focusing on facts and on their professional judgment and their very clear rules. They end up growing the city exactly in the right places, in the urban core, near transit. They've expanded a lot of their transit. The net result is a more lively city. School quality is actually improving because you have an inflow of people in the urban core going to public schools. So it's one of those examples of, you know, many growing tide lift all boats, and I think we should embrace it.
Let's go next to Gray. Gray, welcome to the program. Can you make your comment briefly?
Sure. I'm referring back to it was mentioned earlier about Prop 13
And I'm just interested to hear a little bit more about theories on how the original noble intention of that, which was to help keep seniors and people on fixed income from being taxed out of their houses, really became a blanket, almost loophole for so many people who really didn't need that type of assistance, and resulted in such a lowering of the amount of income cities were able to bring in to provide some of these public services.
How did something so good go so wrong? Enrico?
Well, Prop 13 has many, many negative aspects. One is the one that the callers points out to. Another one is that it makes our state revenue so volatile. So in good times, state revenue balloon. In bad times, they shrink because income is much more volatile than property values. I think there are many reasons to fix it.
Is that going to happen?
You know, the reform that could happen is what they call the split tax rule, which is where property owned by business is taxed normally rather than with Prop 13 protections, which is actually really good for competitiveness because it does not it gets rid of the advantage that incumbents right now have over new entrants to a market.
Okay. Let's go next to George. George, welcome to the program. We have a few minutes, so...
Well, we don't have too long, but it wouldn't matter if we had an hour or two more. It's just a factor that I think we ought to be reading into this discussion and factoring in for the next go-round when you do this topic. Again, what about a new constituency who commutes to San Francisco to sleep, who are people that we do see, and I think everybody here knows about these big buses that have gained access to the bus zone parking, and dropping people and picking them up, but taking them to work in Google or Yahoo or numerous other businesses that we could list. But is anybody talking to those commuters, and do we know who they are and how many of them there are, and what's that doing to the local situation?
What would you be asking those commuters?
Well, for one thing, where were they before they were commuting from a pricey occupational slot in Silicon Valley to San Francisco, where they're paying very high rents? Though, of course, they may not know that they're high rents because we don't know what their experience is. They could be paying $1,500 for a bedroom.
Right. Thank you so much.
Well, all I can say is there's a lot of data on this. The vast, vast majority of the San Francisco residents who commute out of the city drive to work.
All right. So let's go to the – we have to wrap up, unfortunately. I'm sorry we can't get to the last couple of callers here. So in closing, and it sounds like we need another program on this because we've barely scratched the surface, what are some immediate next steps both in raising wages and in lowering cost of living? That's my question to all three of you. Let's do it in turn. Let's start with you, Gabriel, then Enrico, and then we'll end with Bob.
Well, look, we're doing a lot of things right. There are cities like San Francisco with high taxes, lots of city revenue that are using the economic growth to support their progressive values. There are cities like San Jose, where we also are working, that I think don't have high enough taxes and need to increase the size of the public sector in order to do more for their people. While this problem of economic inequality is national and maybe international, there are a few big things we can do at the local level. Let's start by raising the city minimum wage wherever we can.
Okay, Enrico?
I would say let's spend this extra revenue that the tech boom is generating to invest in our local community colleges so that some of the jobs that go to people from outside the city, they go to San Francisco residents.
So far wages and then promoting educational opportunities. And Bob?
I come down on the wage side of the discussion, not just minimum wages and living wages, but efforts to try and develop industries, including public sector initiatives that provide quality jobs. While I always have been a strong supporter of expanding education, the fact is if you have an economy that generates only a small number of good jobs, educating a large number of people to chase after that small number of good jobs doesn't increase the number of people in the middle class.
Well, we're going to have to stop it there, Bob. And I think we should bring all of you back to talk a little bit more about this culture of selfishness and also this idea that there needs to be a groundswell of community engagement to really turn the tide on all this. I want to thank you for joining us this evening and thank especially our guests Enrico Moretti of the University of California, Berkeley, Gabriel Metcalf of Spur, and Bob Brownstein of Working Partnerships USA. If you want to download podcasts or listen to other shows or tell us about what you thought about tonight's program, go to our page at klw.org. Our engineer this evening was Eric Wayne. Tonight's show was produced by Wendy Holcomb. Join my co-host David Onick next Monday as we discuss the potential rise of electric cars. This is Joseph Pache. Thanks for listening. Good night and have a great week.